Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Black Reparations Project, a handbook for racial justice. Edited by William Darity Jr., A. Kirsten Mullen, and Lucas Hubbard. Narrated by Terence Kidd. Publisher's note: this audiobook includes bonus material. Please visit Tantor.com and type the Black Reparations Project into the search box. Follow the link to the book's page, then under the supplemental content section, please enter the access code CASE, and then click the unlock button to access the bonus material. The code should be entered in all lowercase letters. All figures, tables, and appendices referenced in this audiobook can be found in the bonus material. Introduction. William A. Darity Jr., A. Kirsten Mullen, and Lucas Hubbard. During the 2019 phase of the U.S. presidential campaign, a number of serious contenders for the Democratic Party's nomination actually invoked the term reparations, a few even indicating their support for restitution for Black Americans. The leading voice at the time was Marianne Williamson, who recommended an outlay ranging from $100 to $500 billion as recompense for the many decades of racial injustice in the United States. And while they offered no specifics, both Julian Castro and Tom Steyer also endorsed Black reparations. The stresses of the COVID-19 pandemic, coupled with the international protest in response to the highly visible police murders of unarmed Black people, especially the killing of George Floyd, led to an additional dramatic surge in interest in Black reparations in 2020. That interest has carried over to the present, in which more and more racial justice advocates and their allies are proclaiming a desire to pursue a program of redress on behalf of Black America. It is, perhaps, an interest in reparations not witnessed since the Reconstruction era. However, not everyone means the same thing when referring to reparations. Not everyone shares identical views about who should be eligible to receive reparations, what form reparations should take, how large the reparations fund should be, how reparations funds should be distributed, or who should pay the reparations debt. Moreover, this is truly a situation where the devil is in the details. While many Americans can agree, in principle, on the moral case for reparations, there are deep cleavages among reparations proponents over the substance of an actual program of restitution. Many of us engaged in research on Black reparations over the years have long been aware of these sharp differences in visions regarding the features of an act of redress. In 2019, two of the editors of this volume were anticipating the upcoming publication of their book, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, where, in the final chapter, they would offer a detailed plan for Black reparations. They also were aware that others laboring in reparations research were trying to think through similar issues, and they knew that it was highly unlikely that the last chapter of From Here to Equality would be the final word. Coupled with growing national interest in reparations, it was apparent that there would be tremendous value in bringing members of the reparations research community together to further refine and motivate the case and plan for reparations. The Reparations Planning Committee, RPC, assembled with the aim of producing a volume that would function as an extensive guide for designing and implementing a national Black reparations initiative. Financial support for the project came from an award from the William T. Grant Foundation to the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University, given to aid the Cook Center in doing the research to further develop and consolidate an African-American reparations plan. Not all members of the RPC contributed chapters to the volume, but all provided advice and guidance on the path to the current edition. Nor is this a consensus document, per se, although there is consistency in the shared vision of what Black reparations should be among the contributors. All of the essays in this collection have been written with the goal of pushing forward the Black Reparations Project. These essays are working papers for African American reparations, and hence, working papers for a new America. The chapters in this volume fall into two sections. The first section consists of chapters that interrogate and outline the case for reparations through the racial disparities observed across different areas, wealth, housing, education, and health, before highlighting potential and necessary paths to restitution that can be achieved as redress in each area. The second section considers the logistical elements of a reparations plan, potential pitfalls the plan should avoid, eligibility standards for reparations, methods of delivery of reparations, the parties responsible for delivering reparations, and the necessary next steps and timeline for effecting such a plan. William A. Darity, Jr. and A. Kirsten Mullen's opening chapter, Where Does Black Reparations in America Stand?, provides an overview of the evolving terrain of an unfolding national conversation on black reparations. The authors examine the implications of the attempted coup d'etat on January 6, 2021, for the black reparations movement and the policies that have made and sustained the immense racial wealth gap. They outline the four essential pillars of a sound plan for black reparations. Calculation of the size of the bill for reparations starts in earnest, and wealth implications of slavery and racial discrimination for African-American descendants of the enslaved by Thomas Kramer, Trevor Smith, Brianna Harrison, Trevor Logan, Wesley Bellamy, and William A. Darity, Jr. These detailed estimates, ranging from $5 trillion to a fantastic $22 quadrillion, provide a grounding for the remainder of the volume, quantifying the costs of atrocities that later chapters, in particular, the three chapters that immediately follow, which highlight largely post-slavery injustices, study in a more qualitative manner. While the bulk of the chapter highlights various methods for estimating the economic losses black Americans have suffered from slavery times to the current moment, the authors settle on elimination of the racial wealth gap as the fundamental goal of a plan for reparations for black American descendants of U.S. slavery. This chapter previously was published in June 2020 in the Review of Black Political Economy. It is reprinted here with modest editing and data updates with the permission of the authors and the journal. Unequal Housing and the Case for Reparations by Walter D. Grayson addresses the first area of qualitative consideration, studying inequitable housing policies in the U.S. since the Civil War, particularly in the past century, as a basis for reparations. Grayson identifies how the New Deal and civil rights eras, while transforming America's surface appearance, nonetheless failed to transform the racial hierarchy at the country's core. In particular, Grayson writes that policies designed to promote black inclusion and equity were sabotaged in favor of techniques that eradicated the small elements of wealth that black families had gathered during the Jim Crow years. Highlighting the effects in communities across the country, Grayson shows the stagnation of progress that has defined the post-slavery period, the obstacles to equity that black Americans and well-meaning policymakers have faced, and the missed opportunities that have warped the national trajectory. Malik Edwards' chapter, Education Inequities and the Case for Reparations, considers similar shortcomings in the education sphere, providing a history of educational deprivation and its deleterious effects on black well-being. Edwards details the inequities long present in the educational system that persist to this day. Edwards constructs a thoughtful through line between present-day disparities and those of centuries past, showcasing the inability to equalize opportunities for students across all schools and the hesitancy of powerful entities, especially the Supreme Court, to set up and protect enforceable policies that might achieve such a goal. The last chapter of Part 1, written by Keisha Bentley Edwards, focuses on the case for reparations from a health perspective. The African-American health burden, disproportionate and unresolved, looks at how a range of disparate health outcomes for black Americans can be traced back to a litany of policies and practices that have for centuries reduced the quality of, if not outright eliminated, medical care for this population. Bentley Edwards describes how this arena, like many others described in this book, was long defined by outright subjugation and maltreatment of the black body, Moreover, when the Reconstruction era seemingly brought a flicker of opportunity, that hope was quickly squashed, most notably by the Flexner Report of 1910, which culminated in a shuttering of most black medical schools at the time. Finally, as universal policies like the Medicare Bill of 1965 came into being and tried to fix past injustices, they were built upon slanted ground in a discriminatory environment. Thus, these attempts merely managed to create a newly unequal playing field for black medical professionals and, in turn, black patients. The second section of the volume begins with Learning from Past Experiences with Reparations by A. Kirsten Mullen and William A. Darity, Jr., reiterating the focus on closing the racial wealth gap as the preeminent goal for reparations. The authors consider other efforts that have been undertaken, both in America and around the world, in response to previous atrocities. Mullen and Darity study the actions of five commissions that convened to study past atrocities, four of which awarded some form of reparations to victims and/or their families, to identify patterns and lessons for bringing black reparations to fruition. The authors highlight myriad lessons. These commissions can be valuable even without significant popular support for reparations. Indeed, a commission's report could prove valuable in increasing support for black reparations. They also determine that uniform payments largely are desirable, that the perpetrators of the atrocity should not benefit from having committed such actions, and that allies who support the push for reparations are valuable in swaying public opinion. Considerations for the Design of a Reparations Plan by Trayvon D. Logan continues the strategic discussion of logistics for a reparations plan. Logan first notes, among other caveats, that the estimates of the racial wealth gap may be less than the full debt owed to black Americans, both because of the outsized gains achieved by the enslavers and because of the intangible costs that the enslaved and their descendants have been forced to carry across generations. Logan then proceeds to enumerate a bevy of concerns and considerations surrounding the administration of such a program of reparations. Among these, he identifies the need for a committee to be established to study it, the need for the program to be national in scope, the need for it to be based on knowledge obtained from precedents in parallel with Mullen and Darity, and various possibilities regarding the format and funding of payments. Moreover, Logan emphasizes the need for a more factual treatment of American history and its record of racial atrocities, both as a necessary element of the process of restitution and as a means of engendering support for redress. Lisa R. Brown's chapter, Reparations and Adult Education, Civic and Community Engagement for Lifelong Learners, focuses on the role that adult education can play in the reparations push. Brown highlights the opportunity for this field, which has been at the forefront of numerous American social justice movements, to advance reparations by increasing general public knowledge and support. The latter sections of the chapter explore Brown's adaptation of Claire Graves's ECLET, Emergent Cyclical Levels of Existence Theory framework, outlining stages of adult development in terms of individual and collectivist thinking. Brown posits that it could be a useful tool in identifying those adults most likely to become supporters of black reparations, as well as cultivating through education the kinds of collectivist thinking that are most likely to lead to reparation support. The framework, in conjunction with adult development provided by the educational systems Brown highlights, provides a path to forging the necessary broader coalition for this cause. The Children of Slavery, Genealogical Research and the Establishment of Eligibility for Reparations, written by Evelyn A. McDowell, considers logistics and the process of delivering reparations to eligible individuals. Building off the qualifying criteria outlined by Darity and Mullen, McDowell delineates a methodical process both for identifying relatives and for acquiring supporting evidence that establishes an ancestor's enslaved status. McDowell walks readers through the types of source materials, census, federal, property, and other records, that can prove valuable in this research process. She presents a system for evaluating the strength of pieces of evidence, and she showcases this in two rich and nuanced examples. McDowell's chapter is a powerful rejoinder to critics who believe that it is impossible to establish a genealogical trail to one's enslaved ancestors. Darity and Mullen's concluding chapter, On the Black Reparations Highway, Avoiding the Detours, explores common complaints lodged against black reparations, as well as alternative plans that have been suggested in lieu of a comprehensive form of targeted payments to black Americans. The chapter also argues that local initiatives labeled as reparations, congressional legislation to form a study commission for black reparations, H.R. 40, the charge that reparations must be more than a check, and an array of proposed universal or indirect measures to close the wealth gap are diversions from an essential comprehensive national plan for reparations. The conclusion makes clear that nothing but reparations conducted at the federal level will alleviate the black wealth gap, and that if equality is the goal, then nothing but true reparations will suffice. Taken as a whole, the chapters found in the Black Reparations Project provide a wide-ranging and emphatic argument for this long-overdue cause. The journey to get to this point has been arduous, and while there is some momentum currently, much ground still must be covered before redress becomes reality. Our hope is that the contents of this book and its presence in the nation's wider discourse in the coming years will motivate, guide, and speed the final leg of the journey. Part 1. The Context and Cases for Reparations. 1. Where does black reparations in America stand? William A. Darity, Jr. and A. Kirsten Mullen. Of Coups in the Confederacy. On January 6, 2021, urged on by President Trump's false claim that the 2020 election had been stolen from him, a terrorist mob invaded the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. The intent was to execute a coup d'etat to maintain Trump's regime. Imperiling elected officials from both parties, the Capitol invaders brought with them the trappings and regalia of the Confederacy. They also carried the full spirit and heritage of the Confederacy. In the aftermath of the Civil War, it was the defeated Confederates who violently sought to win the peace by a campaign of sustained terror directed against the freedmen. Time and again, they overthrew duly elected local governments co-governed by coalitions of newly emancipated blacks and pro-Union whites, including ousters of elected officials at St. Landry Parish in Louisiana in 1868, Colfax, Louisiana, in 1873, Coushatta, Louisiana, in 1874, Vicksburg, Mississippi, in 1874, Fort Bend County in Texas, in 1888, and Wilmington, North Carolina, in 1898. The January 6th assault on the national government runs in a straight line from the most concerted previous attempt to destroy the United States of America, the secession of the 11 states that formed the Confederate States of America 163 years ago. Indeed, the attempted coup on January 6th is symptomatic of the long-term failure to deconfederatize American society. In contrast with Germany's active policy of denazification, nothing similar has occurred with respect to the prominence of the lost cause narrative of the nation's history and the memorialization of the leaders of the Southern secession. We frequently hear the aphorism, "The winners write the history," but this has not been the case with respect to U.S. history. Via organizations like the United Daughters of the Confederacy, UDC, and the Daughters of the American Revolution, DAR, the Confederates and their ideological descendants crafted the story of the nation's past. In the United States, the losers of the Civil War, have faced little resistance as they have written the nation's history. False images abound of kindly slaveholders generously conducting a civilizing mission on behalf of the Africans who were held as their human property, of the Civil War as motivated by the pursuit of states' rights, of Reconstruction as a travesty of black misrule under the manipulation of scalawags and carpetbaggers, and of the Confederates as dignified patriots seeking to preserve the principles of the American Revolution. All of these lies are a product of the work of the UDC and the DAR. They have suppressed the accurate narrative of the formation of the Confederacy as a traitorous act born of insistence on maintaining an oppressive system of economic exploitation. The Lost Cause narrative also has served as a powerful prop to hide an accurate story of the path taken toward white wealth accumulation and black wealth deprivation in the United States. Black Americans are characterized collectively as less intelligent, less motivated, more profligate, more likely to undervalue education, more likely to be ineffective parents, and/or more prone to criminality than whites. This characterization of black people as immature and largely dysfunctional in the absence of white discipline and supervision dates directly to the perspective taken by slavery apologists. There is a striking commonality between the Democratic Party of the latter half of the 19th century and the Republican Party in the latter half of the 20th century to the present. Both are parties of the Confederacy. Both are parties that champion minority rule. Both raise the torch of the lost cause. Both are committed to erasure of an accurate presentation of the American story. An accurate story of the divergence in wealth and general economic well-being between blacks and whites in the United States would aim directly at the national policies conducted by the federal government that have built white wealth while, simultaneously, inhibiting the growth of black wealth. Evidence of how public policy has been mobilized to create and sustain the black-white wealth gap provides a clear motivation for the use of public policy to develop a reparations program to eliminate the gap. Wealth, race, and public policy. The most recent survey conducted by the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve on wealth in the United States was completed in 2019, prior to the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. It indicated that the median white household had a net worth of $164,100, greater than the median black household. At the mean, the average white household had a net worth $841,900 greater than the average black household. It is routine for analysts to prefer to evaluate disparities at the median, the middle of the distribution, rather than the mean, since the median is not sensitive to outlying values and, presumably, provides a more accurate picture of the typical condition of members of each group. But in the context of racial differences in wealth, the mean gap offers the superior measure for policy purposes. This is so, one of us has argued, because wealth is so densely concentrated in the United States that 97% of white Americans' total wealth is held by households with a net worth above the white median, and white households with a net worth above the national median, which is approximately $100,000, hold close to 99% of white wealth. 25% of white households have a net worth in excess of $1 million, in contrast with a mere 4% of black households. Using the median figure would take an overwhelming share of white wealth off the table. We propose that a true reparations plan, rather than taking that vast amount of wealth off the table, must focus on elimination of the black-white wealth disparity at the mean rather than the median. Black Americans with ancestors enslaved in the United States constitute about 12% of the nation's population, but possess less than 2% of the nation's wealth. To bring the share of wealth held by this segment of the black population, actually, about 90% of the black population in the United States into consistency with their share of the population will necessitate a reparations plan for setting the mean gap as its target for closure. How did this enormous racial gulf in wealth come about? The gulf is the intentional effect of national policies that built white wealth at the expense of black American wealth accumulation. In an article we prepared for The Economist, we identified four periods of American public policy that contributed directly to the creation of the black-white wealth gap: the wagon train period, the bloodlust period, the picket fence period, and the freeway period. The wagon train period. In the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, a pledge was made to the formerly enslaved that they would receive 40-acre land grants as restitution for their years of subjugation. That pledge was never fulfilled. President Lincoln's emissary, Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, and General William T. Sherman met in Savannah, Georgia, in January 1865, with a group of 20 representatives from black communities to chart the post-war agenda. When asked what they desired, the spokesperson for the black leadership group, Reverend Garrison Frazier, said the freedmen wanted to have land and turn it and till it by our own labor, until we are able to buy it and make it our own. He also said, with great prescience, that blacks prefer to live among themselves because there is a prejudice against us in the South that will take years to get over. They wanted to be left alone to make their own tomorrow. A few days later, Sherman issued Special Orders No. 15, designating a 5.3 million-acre strip of land stretching from South Carolina Sea Islands to the St. Johns River in northern Florida as a territory to be set aside in 40-acre allotments to the formerly enslaved. This was supposed to be a first phase of a land reform that would have assigned at least 40 million acres of land to the 4 million freedmen. A process of settlement began, with 40,000 freedmen taking over 400,000 acres of land. But, in the aftermath of Lincoln's assassination, his successor, Andrew Johnson, simultaneously a Unionist and a white supremacist, rolled back all policies intended to give the newly emancipated full citizenship, including the land reform policy. Even the partial allotment of 400,000 acres was restored to the former slaveholders. In contrast, the federal government introduced the Homestead Act in 1862 to complete its colonial settler project in the Western Territories by distributing 160-acre land allotments to 1.5 million white households, including recent European immigrants. This was land the U.S. government occupied that previously had been home to indigenous peoples. While the projected allocation of 40 acres to the freedmen was one quarter of the size of the Homestead Act patents, ultimately the freedmen received nothing. Trina Williams Shanks has estimated that, today, at least 45 million living white Americans are beneficiaries of the Homestead Act. The Bloodlust Period. Between the end of the Civil War and the end of World War II, white terrorists conducted upward of 100 massacres of black communities with impunity, listed in Appendix A, which can be found in the bonus materials. Because of the recent attention drawn to it by the centennial commemoration and by a popular cultural treatment in the television program Watchmen, the Tulsa Massacre of 1921 probably is the most well-known. In 1919 alone, the year of the Red Summer, upward of 40 white attacks on black communities took place across the country in locations as far-flung as Bisbee, Arizona, Chicago, Wilmington, Delaware, and Elaine, Arkansas. The federal government either implicitly or explicitly sanctioned these acts of mob violence. Indeed, in the case of the Ocoee, Florida massacre in 1920, Congress actually issued a commendation to the mobsters for upholding law and order. In 1921, in Tulsa, incendiary devices were dropped from decommissioned World War I U.S. Army airplanes on homes and businesses in the prosperous Black Greenwood district of the city. This, literally, was the firebombing of Greenwood. In all these episodes, black lives were lost. Especially relevant to the creation of the racial wealth gap is the fact that, typically, black property was also seized by white terrorists to become their own. Frequently, the objective was to block black participation in electoral politics, but just as often, the objective was to undermine black economic prosperity. In Ocoee, Florida, both objectives were plainly on display. The Picket Fence Period. In the 20th century, federal asset-building policy shifted from the provision of land to the promotion of home ownership. Here again, white Americans benefited, and black Americans did not. Residential segregation, crystallizing with the development of restrictive covenants early in the century, drove a wedge between the values of black-owned.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?